Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Scott Linden here. Glad you could join me. Some education this week on the show. Hope you will learn something or remember something and pass it on to a shooting or a hunting or a bird dog oriented friend as well. So starting off, our industry insider segment this week is from Scott Trulock of Trulock Chokes. Yeah, they've been they've been in the business a long time. They know what they're doing, and of course, I support them. They support me, and so on and so forth. We'll be talking about patterning your shotgun, some of the new ammo choices, and which non-toxic is your best choice. And we'll learn a little bit more about how they make choke tubes as good as they do. And then our second industry insider this week is Jim Burris. He's the founder of the Bird Dog Society. This organization has had a relatively low profile, but is now standing tall in the world of doing service for the dogs that do service for us. Learn more about the organization and what you can do and what you can do to help. Our road trip this week, a listener asked about how to get away from all those annoying side-by-sides, the off-highway vehicles. We'll talk about that, and I'll have some strategies based on my own experience there. And then I asked you all where you hunted this year. I don't want the latitude and longitude. No, I mean, did you hunt in-state or out-state? How many of you went out-of-state? Some fascinating stuff there as well. It's all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast. We're made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Pointer Shotguns, Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School, Trulock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport, LandTrust.com, ESPAmerica.com, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. Well, I don't know about you, but I am deep into training mode. One step at a time, you know, I don't work on too many things at once. Still got to make a living like you. So I'm trying to be strategic. And the last few days, at least, I've been working, well, a little polishing up on all the bird contact stuff with Flick. And we're still making progress there. It's just a matter of a whole bunch of repetitions. You know that. But I've reintroduced the whole idea of blind retrieves. Yeah, that's how bad a shooter I am. So I have to do a lot of asking of my dog to find birds that he didn't see go down. And I didn't even know I hit sometimes. No, not really. But anyway, you know how valuable a blind retrieve can be and how hard it is to teach that. So I'm back to square one, starting at close distances, dropping a bird while he's not watching, and then bringing him directly downwind, and only 30, 40, 50 yards on the first one of the day. Popping the popper and directing him in the general area, and then letting him just use his nose and find the dead bird. That works pretty well when he's straight downwind. Of course, that's the idea to motivate him. And then after that, we're doing some crosswind work, and then we're extending the distances. It's kind of like, a dry land version of the NAVDA duck search, which we're also going to be working on later in the summer when it gets a little warmer. But anyway, it seems to be working, and I think it's a great kind of mental challenge for a dog as well. If he understands what you're asking for, and that's the key. So if you're working on that as well, maybe you back up a little bit, shorten some distances, make sure he has success with the first one every day. Working for us, I'll keep you posted. And then, always wondering what you're doing and love to hear from you on so many issues. And I appreciate those who actually made comments from our Upland Nation Insights newsletter, always asking questions there. And one I'm always interested in is how many of you went out of state last year to hunt? And I think it was a record-setting amount. Over the years, I've asked this question in various places. 58% of us hunted out of state last season. That's incredible. Now, I understand. And, you know, I got some great answers in there. Oh, my regular spots are too crowded. I'm always looking for new adventure. I got a bucket list bird I got to chase down. I love to visit new places and see new scenery. They're all great. And then one that I just hit on, because I always go back, even if I don't shoot a lot of birds, I always go back to a couple places at least once per season. And you know why I go there? And maybe you have the same thing. The people. Yeah. You know, you're welcome. I go to one place where the population is 9. Yeah. I think I know all 9 of them. And they're all great people. Salt of the earth. Wonderful folks. This is cattle country in the middle of nowhere. And then I got another place that's up in timber country. Much the same. Population a little bit bigger, but well, big enough to have an old-fashioned 4th of July parade, which is how we discovered the place. But maybe you take a moment. Here's your exercise, your assignment for the day. Think about why you went out of state, if you did, and what it was that just warmed the cockles of your heart. And the 42% of you that didn't go, maybe those are reasons to think about it next time around. We're brought to you in part by Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food. ProPlanSport.com is where you learn more about the nutritional research that this organization has done for us over the decades and why their formulations are always a 30% protein, 20% fat formulation. Various types, depending on your dog's life, lifestyle, and age, for example. But all of them are designed for canine athletes who need to excel in the field every day, all season. One of the ways they do that is they concentrate the nutrition so that it optimizes oxygen metabolism, VO2 max, just like the bike racers and the marathon runners. That increases endurance during exercise. Look to ProPlanSport.com and see if there's a formulation that might work for your canine athlete as well. And Hi-Vis Shooting Systems has always had a vision, pardon the pun, to improve the sport of shooting. Founded by a clay target shooter and a bird hunter, so all of their sights are designed to help you create the right sight picture for your shooting game. HIVIZ sights.com, HiVizSights.com. See what you've been missing. Take a look at all the different styles and types of shotgun sights that you might be able to put to use. Magnetic, screw attached, plain barrel sights, even I can install them. There's a reason they're original equipment on Ruger, Smith & Wesson, Benelli, Browning, and Remington. More information, HiVizSights.com. You know, having started journalism life as a business reporter, I get a real kick out of talking business with business people about the business of bird hunting and bird dogs. And here's my chance once again to get some information for all of us that I'm sure will make us a better shooter. Joining me from Wigham, Georgia, Scott Trulock, the president of Trulock Chokes. Scott, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast and the Industry Insider feature.
Hey, Scott. Appreciate you having me on again.
You know, I would just have you read the phone book with that accent, and I think everybody would get a kick out of it, but I'm not going to, I promise. First off, let's talk about Trulock Chokes and what's new over there.
We've got several new things. Some of them haven't released yet. Some of them are coming for this fall, so I'm not going to get too far into it, other than saying we do have some new stuff coming, but I don't want to get the fire started too early on it. But be on the lookout for some new chokes, both for waterfowl and for upland hunting. that we should have ready midsummer, I'm thinking.
Wonderful.
A little higher end, gussied up a little bit. Everybody likes shiny, flashy things. These won't be shiny nor flashy, but they will look really cool.
And they will act really cool, and that's the key, of course.
Absolutely.
As long as it helps me shoot.
We don't sell anything that we don't think is going to work, no matter how good it looks.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. When I was at, one of the bazillion shows where I brought home all sorts of fun stuff plus a virus this winter, I said to somebody, oh, yeah, Scott Trulock chokes, blah, blah, blah. And it was a shotgun manufacturer, I think. And he said, well, will their tubes fit our gun? I said, I don't know. And I think he ended up going down and saying hello and then promising to send you a barrel or two. Is that how you do that stuff? If I've got a relatively obscure shotgun or it's new on the market in the States, how do you guys figure out how to make choke tubes for that gun?
Well, a lot of times, if it's let's just start with the new gun to the market, if it's something that we don't have an inside knowledge of, a manufacturer passes along, hey, this is what it is and this is what it takes. And a lot of times we'll just go buy a couple of them.
Yeah.
And see for ourselves. There have been more than one occasion where you get told it's one thing and it might be close, but it's not quite. So then you have to figure out a way to make a new choke tube to fit brand X gun, whatever it may be. And in the case of customers with oddball stuff, a lot of times I'll just have them send in a choke tube.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That they currently have.
Yeah.
And we can, most of the time, we can just reverse engineer their choke tube to fit whatever application they're after. If it's something really hinky, I will have them send in a barrel so I can make sure that what we're doing is going to fit when they get it.
There's got to be a whole lot of science involved in that stuff, or engineering, I should say.
It is. I remember when I was going through high school, this math is for the birds. I never use this. I use it every single day, and I tell my kids, don't discount it. You never know what you might end up needing to know.
Oh, my. That may well be the first practical example of mathematics I've ever heard. Sorry, Mr. Mescon, my seventh grade algebra teacher. He tried to make it relevant, but he never used choke tubes as the reason.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. You showed me something in Las Vegas that's a bit of a departure for a choke tube company, but it is new, and I want you to brag on it.
Yes, sir. That will be the Trulock Model 67 22 rimfire rifle. It's a project my daddy George started back in 20. Well, he started doing some legwork on it back in 21, but really got rolling in the last part of the first part of 22. Of course, that's before he got real bad sick, but
yeah.
But 21, 22, he started working on this thing, and me and my brother Jared are bringing it to market finally. I think we're going to be there early summer, midsummer.
Wow.
Before when we're ready to release this thing. But it's going to be it's a single shot bolt action pull to cock rifle. It's a reproduction, if you will, of the Winchester Model 67.
Okay.
It is a far cry from the Winchester Model 67. We have really gone through this thing and tried to make it the best single shot 22 that you will ever get your hands on. The only thing, the original Winchester used a bunch of stampings for various parts.
Mm-hmm.
The only stamped parts that we're going to have on this thing are some springs. You can't get away from that.
Yeah.
You can't machine a spring. Everything else on it is machined. About 90% of the machined parts are done here at Trulock.
Wow.
We've got another company working with us. they're doing the stocks for us. Of course, we're having another company make the sites. So there are a few things that we're having to outsource. But most of the work is being done in-house by us, and we are machining these parts, not stamping them. So you're getting a really, really nice rifle, something that's going to be around forever if you take care of it. You know, you're not going to wear this thing out.
Well, and again, pardon my lack of knowledge of that sort of stuff, but I understand the difference between a stamped and a machined part. But practically speaking, what does that mean to a shooter, especially of a what's going to become an heirloom gun? Is it about lifespan for those parts? Is it about anything else in there? For example, efficiency or accuracy or anything like that?
Machine parts tend to have tighter tolerances than stamped parts, and you can machine it so that everything fits exactly how it's supposed to.
Yeah. Is there a particular material you want to use for those, or does it matter?
We're doing everything that we can in stainless steel.
Wow.
Some of it is not. Just for design purposes. But most of the machine parts are stainless. The bolt handle, all that stainless. The safety is stainless, and some of the other parts are not. But again, unnecessary to make them out of stainless.
Yeah.
You really don't gain anything one way or another by using. We're using a lot of some of the parts are 4140 steel, which is very common in the gun industry.
Mm-hmm.
4140 for 4130 barrels are made from it, receivers are made from it. So that's a common material within the gun industry to be used. But the parts that are exposed are stainless. We've got a machined trigger guard on it, and everything we're doing as to the highest quality as we possibly can.
Do you think there's some positive fallout over there in the factory from doing a project like this when it comes to making a choke tube down the road?
Some of the stuff we're learning, I'm sure it will be used in future projects. You know, choke tubes is our bread and butter. And I hope this rifle becomes a large part of the company. But we do all kinds of odds and ends, you know. For instance, I'm getting before when you called before, I was getting ready to set up to run some parts for an aircraft manufacturer.
Mm.
So we dabble in everything.
Yeah. If we want to learn more about that rifle, we're probably going to have to wait a little bit longer on that.
Once we get a little closer,
yeah.
We'll be putting out lots of information.
Great.
About this thing.
Okay.
Availability, you know, details on it, all the stuff that folks want to know if they're interested.
Okay.
We will have that available.
And check, stay on top of that, everybody, at truelockchokes.com. Of course, there's always something there. I'm looking right now. Receive a free choke case. Let me move my little thing here. Orders over $99.99, for example. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast. That's Scott Truelock on that end. He's the president of TruelockChokes.com. Let's get back to bird hunting in particular, because this is practice season for us. And so we have the chance to actually possibly get better at shooting. I know I do have that opportunity. If we were to, you know, want to be a better bird hunter, but we were forced, for example, to use steel shot, either philosophically or because we hunt waterfowl production areas or whatever. TSS, the tungsten super shot, I think is what that is. That's coming. Mm-hmm. That's down the road. But, you know, most upland bird hunters aren't going to spend a couple, $3 a round on that stuff. They're going to buy the steel shot shells instead. What is the importance of choke tube considerations when it comes to steel shot?
Well, you got one. The biggest thing to remember with steel shot is even in your small 7.5s, number 7 steel shot, it patterns tighter than a comparable number 7 or 7.5 lead load.
Yeah.
The bigger the shot is, the more extreme that difference gets.
Okay.
Typically, your waterfowl loads will pattern at least one full constriction tighter with steel shot than it would with a comparable lead load.
Okay.
And you also, you know, if you're shooting factory chokes, you got to be careful, especially with your larger diameter steel shot. Some of these things look like they were made with a hammer and a chisel when they come from the factory. And the quality of the steel is often called into question. The steel they use to make a choke tube. Not a rifle. The shotgun itself is probably made from, you know, very good steel, 4130, 4140, something like that. So no worries there. But choke tubes a lot of times just seem to be an afterthought. So if you've got a really poor quality choke, chances are if you're slinging steel through it, you're going to have issues with it.
It
tends to overcome the strength of the choke tube,
yeah,
and it'll expand in your barrel, and then you've got a fixed choke gun if you don't catch it soon enough.
Okay, so two things already I'm taking away. Number one, I'm going to open up my chokes by at least one size constriction first, mm-hmm. and second is I never thought about that. The steel shot may be, in effect, harder than the choke tube metal, it sounds like.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yikes. Well, obviously, that's a good enough reason to consider an aftermarket choke. Are there other things in the manufacturing process that you guys use that we don't know about when it comes to choke quality?
We just buy very good quality steel.
Steel.
Scott.
Yeah.
All of our chokes, for purposes of this conversation, are made from 17.4 pH stainless steel.
Okay.
Hardened to about 42 to 44 RC. So it can be done, but you've got to work really hard to tear one of them up if you're going by our recommendations. Now, if you want to do your own thing and shoot, you know, a turkey choke with BB size steel or T size steel, you can go ahead and do it, but we told you not to. And when that thing swells up in your barrel, don't come crying to us. Of course, nobody has ever done that. You understand?
Yeah. And kids, don't try this at home.
Nope.
But I get it.
But
yeah.
As long as you stay within the recommendations that we've got on our, about every piece of information we put out regarding steel shot, you know, we tell you, you know, the choke range to stay in and what's safe to use, what's not. And as long as you'll stay within those recommendations, you'll be fine. But you absolutely can. If you constrict the choke too much, too tight of a constriction with especially the bigger steel, then you could have problems. And you have to, because steel sucks, you have to push it faster. You know, most steel shot loads are 1,400 feet per second.
Okay.
Or better. So that's something else that's adding stress to the choke tube. You have to push the steel faster because it's light.
It has not. It has less mass.
Less mass.
Yeah.
And it's just not a really great option for what we're trying to do with it. You know, but for a long time it was the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
after they come along with all the environmental rules, not using lead and whatnot, and that's getting worse. So. The steel shot thing, it works. Obviously, it works, but there are better options. And I know TSS is expensive, but bismuth is a better option, and not nearly as expensive as TSS. It is more expensive than steel, but it works much better also.
And you know, when you think about how many actual shots you make in a bird hunting situation, it's the cost per round is negligible compared to the gas you bought to get there, for example. You know, the other thing about that is, what has been your experience with bismuth and choke tube constrictions? Do we shoot the same as we would with a traditional lead load in that case?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Years ago, bismuth was a thing.
Yeah.
And then it went away. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but now it's back. And what I've tested so far from most manufacturers, it shoots really, really well. And it's heavier than steel.
Yep.
It's just a better shot option as far as non-tox goes if you don't want to shoot tungsten.
You get all these calls from all these people like me all the time. Is there any trend, or is there a number one question you guys put up on the lunchroom blackboard that, you know, that everybody gets every week?
Yep. What choke should I use? What constriction?
You mean
that's
like
the number one question?
Really? All right. Well, walk me through the answer, Scott Trulock.
It's all dependent. It varies from situation to situation. You know, if you're shooting over dogs, a lot of times you're going to be able to get up close and take a fairly close shot. So you don't need a full choke in your gun. You know, maybe an improved cylinder will work just fine for the majority of your shots. You're always going to have the exception to that.
Sure.
But if you're walking birds up and they're out there running ahead of you, they're not going to let you get real close before they bust and get in the air. So in that case, you're going to want a tighter choke, some improved, modified, even full choke. For most, and that's dependent on, again, what kind of shot shells you're using.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're using tungsten, you know, I'd probably pick a middle ground choke, like a Skeet 2, because tungsten performs so well, you don't need a super tight pattern at longer ranges to make it work. And it's still open enough at close range where you don't have to worry about shooting past the bird. Bismuth, I would treat it just like lead. You know, you can pick your poison with either a, you know, most of my shots are going to be within 30 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I need an improved cylinder or not. You know, I know from experience these birds are going to bust out in front of me, getting up at 30 yards and heading away from me. But I'm going to need something tighter. In that case, you're going to want a tighter choke. And steel, same thing applies. Steel shot, I would, whatever you think you would normally use for the distance you're shooting, let's just say improved cylinder again, for your close range shots. And if you're using larger shot, absolutely back it down one constriction. If you're using smaller shot, you might be able to get away with the same constriction you'd use with lead, but again, you're going to have to pattern your gun, and that's the thing I was leading into.
Good.
And no matter what we tell you, this is all based on our shooting with our chokes and our guns with the ammunition we've chosen to test with, because we cannot shoot it all. There's just too much out there, you know, too many different brands and options of throw weights and feet per second. And everything, you know, all that makes a difference as to how you're going patterns. Take our choke with your selected load and go pattern it before you go hunting.
So most of us, I would suggest, don't have ready access to a range with a pattern board. I always suggest, if nothing else, everybody can probably find a refrigerator box and then, you know, shoot a few times into that and see what your pattern looks like. Yeah, beyond that, though, are there any other things that somebody who's doing a DIY patterning exercise that they should do or look for when they look at the box itself?
Yep. So shoot it at the ranges you're expecting to use in the field.
Yeah.
And try to shoot, we always like to shoot from a rest versus off hand, because in this instance you are you're trying to find out what your gun is doing. We're not worried about what how good a shooter you are.
Right.
Just want to know what your combination is doing.
So we want to basically essentially aim our shotgun, and this is the only time, but this is when we want to aim our shotgun.
Yeah, you want to take out, you know, wobbling around, all that sort of stuff. Just like you were shooting a rifle, aim it at your paper.
Right.
Pull the trigger, go see what you got. And what you're looking for, in wing shooting, we typically pattern 30-inch diameter patterns. And you're looking for an evenly distributed pattern with no holes big enough for your game to get through without taking multiple hits.
Yeah. And I
now,
think
I've shot, I don't know how many, I wouldn't even care to guess how many times I've pulled the trigger on the patterning board. I've never seen a perfect pattern.
Yeah.
They just don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, if I can figure that out, I'll be able to retire shortly. But there's always going to be, from shot to shot, even out of the same box of ammo, you may have a void here and there. But if you pull the trigger again, it's not going to be in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
But you're just trying to get, you know, average. Don't go by one shot.
Right.
Take multiple shots. We shoot a minimum of a 10-shot string whenever we're trying to figure out patterns. That's just kind of the accepted practice to give you a good average. Most folks are not going to do that. I understand it. Even two or three is better than just one. That way you can kind of see from shot to shot how things may change with you.
Well, there you have it from the guy who knows chokes inside and out. His name is on them. That's Scott Trulock. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast, our industry insider feature. Scott, always a pleasure to speak with you. Learned something again today. I got to quit doing that. But definitely helpful. And good luck with the rifle, the new stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing from you as we get deeper into summer and what we can talk about. Thanks so much, Scott Trulock, again with Trulock Chokes. Thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Hey, don't go away. We've got a lot more to talk about in my road trip segment, trying to help, well, more than one of you, I'm sure, but the question came from one of you, and that is, how do I get away from all those guys with their motorized 4x4 type vehicles that are overrunning some of the country, particularly in the West? I'll answer that question in my own special way coming up after this word from LandTrust.com. You know, I'm still working on that Montana trip for this fall, so if you have some suggestions, I'm open to them. Sharptails mid-season, you know, say mid-September or thereabouts, so that it's a little cooler and the birds are still not coveyed up. But I have a lot of choices. In fact, the last time I looked at LandTrust.com, they had over 50 places for me to book a day or a week. So me and my dog and some close friends can find a vetted private piece of ground to hunt. Yeah, take a look for yourself, whether it's Montana, North Dakota, Nebraska, or anywhere else that you want to go. Take a look at the map and shop around at LandTrust.com for your day or your week of private ground hunting. Yeah, LandTrust.com is where I would go and start my trip. And thanks again, Scott Trulock, for being part of the Upland Nation, and also for all of the insights you've given us. And if listeners, if you are looking to learn more about why choke tubes are so important, just go to trulockchokes.com. All sorts of educational information in there that you will appreciate, from pattern boards that you can just look at and see how it all works, to engineering-oriented information if you're so inclined. Every Trulock choke comes with a lifetime warranty and a satisfaction guarantee. There's always an incentive of one sort or another. Sign up for the email notifications and you'll hear about sales and other promotions before everybody else. It's all at trulockchokes.com. Well, I've watched the organization since its inception, if you will, and excited to see them, you know, just passing milestone after milestone. The Bird Dog Society is the name of the group. The founder is Jim Burris. He joins me from somewhere on the East Coast where it's raining there, too. Jim, welcome to the Industry Insider segment of the Upland Nation podcast.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Thanks for reaching out to us. I'm excited to be on here and spread the word on about the Bird Dog Society.
Well, why don't you start with just that? Give us an overview, you know, the elevator pitch for the Bird Dog Society.
Yeah, so the Bird Dog Society was created we launched in January of 2023. So we're fairly new, a little over a year old. And we were created to promote the physical and mental well-being of bird dogs through providing events, education, and outreach for bird dog owners. Basically, what we want to do is make the bird dog ownership process easier so people can build that unbreakable bond with their dog, because there's a few things we want to try to combat. And one of those is there's currently over 300 nonprofits in the United States alone for rehoming surrendered bird dogs. But there's not a nonprofit out there that tries to build that bond and provide resources for the owners so that, you know, they never have to make that difficult decision. So,
well, it sounds, if I may, it sounds more like a preventive act than what some of those rescue groups are doing.
Yeah. And, you know, our goal is for people to be active and engaged with their dogs. You know, a lot of times people get these bird dogs and don't realize the prey drive and energy demands and intelligence of these dogs, and so they get off more than bite off more than they could chew, so to speak, and so that's where we kind of step in. And we have ambassadors throughout the U.S. Like I said, we're, you know, a little over a year old, so we're kind of expanding a lot of our programs right now, and our ambassadors in the various different states actually provide feedback to the board of directors to let us know what kind of events and resources are needed in those areas, what's the biggest need for the bird dog community in various states. And then we can put either, you know, we can step in and kind of almost be like a mentor for people with bird dogs to teach them how to, you know, learn to upland hunt or a waterfowl hunt, or, you know, is it people have these dogs and they know how to hunt, but they're afraid to take their dog out because they're afraid of, you know, barbed wire or ticks and rattlesnakes and porcupines and stuff. So we do a lot of educational workshops and stuff like that to give people the skills and the confidence to, you know, kind of take their dog outside and be active and engaged with them.
It sounds like a lot of these people are first-time bird dog owners. Would that be safe to assume?
We see a little bit of both. You know, there's a lot of people that come to the Bird Dog Society with new dogs. You know, the spouse gets a bird dog, and then they go off to work and leave it with their husband or wife, and so you know, everybody in the whole family has to, you know, be a part of a bird dog. Owning a bird dog is a bird dog lifestyle. And so part of it is learning how to live that lifestyle and be a cohesive unit with that family. But what we see a lot of is experienced dog owners, particularly with our first aid and trauma training, clinics and stuff like that. We get a lot of experienced dog owners that take part in those. But, you know, the kind of the local impact that ambassadors and eventually chapters will have in states That's where we hope to pull in a lot of those more experienced and established people in those areas, to where we're actually going out and doing volunteer opportunities out on public lands to remove unneeded barbed wire, or maybe fill in abandoned wells, or remove, you know, other hazards that your bird dog may encounter on public lands. And then, you know, going out and building duck blinds on public lands or maintaining ones that are already there. You know, there's a lot of states in the East that have state operated waterfowl impoundments. And, you know, there's not great access to these impoundments. So a lot of times people have to go, you know, sometimes miles back into these impoundments. And so it's really difficult to get like a blind back there or something like that. So if we can work with states to actually put resources on public land, so it makes people more willing to take their dog out there and participate in these outdoor activities. And, you know, those are areas that we want to, you know, kind of provide resources for local and experienced bird dog owners as well. So we're really a big tent organization.
I'll say
bird dog, you know, so it doesn't matter if you have labs, flushers, or pointers. You know, our goal is there's ever, you know, easily over 3.5 million bird dogs in the U.S. And that's just registered bird dogs. And so we're an organization that kind of that wants to be a voice for those bird dogs and for those bird dog owners. So.
Well, let's talk about your bird dog. Why would a guy like you get involved in all this? And I'm presuming it's because you have bird dogs and you're a hunter and you see the need. But what does Jim Burris do during hunting season?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had bird dogs now for, oh gosh, I got my first bird dog when I was about 24. It was an English setter, Ryman setter. I'm originally from West Virginia. And that's kind of one of the breeds to have up there, being mm-hmm. close to, you know, kind of old Hemlock and Walt Lesser and, you know, a lot of the Ryman setter pioneers. And so that was my first bird dog. And really that dog was just a kind of a meat dog. You know, I'm not sure I like that term, but you know, that's,
but we know what we're talking about.
Yeah. And so that dog, passed away of old age, and I took a couple of years off as, you know, I tried to, you know, develop my career and family. And then I switched and I got a poodle pointer. And so that's my current dog right now. I'm a one or two dog guy. And so we do a lot of upland hunting mostly, but he loves the water. So we do waterfowl, whenever he drags me out there. But we do a lot of stuff like, adventure hiking and shed hunting and stuff like that too. So we try to stay pretty active. I mean, every morning I go out for about a 2 to 3 mile walk and he goes for a, you know, 5 to 10 mile run.
Yeah.
But, you know, this kind of the whole idea started while hunting in North Dakota. And literally we had 9 dogs hunting for a week in our party. And it was just going through barbed wire after barbed wire after barbed wire. And there was certainly some lacerations and stuff that dogs received through the week. It wasn't anything to put a dog down. But I was like, man, there needs to be an organization that just kind of has bird dogs' best interest in mind. And I dwelled on that for a little bit. And, you know, and then when I got my poodle pointer, of course, the poodle pointer breed is heavily evolved with connected with NABDA for the testing system and stuff like that. And so I got heavily involved with NABDA once I got my poodle pointer, who's 4.5 years old now. And through that process, I was involved with various chapters. North Carolina is blessed with 4 different NABDA chapters here. And I kept going to these training days and I would see people with brand new puppies and never hunted or never had a bird dog. They come to training days and, you know, they just, you know, kind of had a blank look. They look lost. And I was like, all right, so how can we help you? And you would help them. They leave that day, dog happy. They seem happy, but then you never see them again.
Yeah.
I was like, well, where's the disconnect? You know, what resources do these people need to keep them involved in NABDA or AKC or whatever to keep that dog active, engaged?
Yeah.
Is that the dog that is chewing up a sofa every week and is eventually going to get, you know, surrendered to one of these foster nonprofits? You know, and I was always curious about, like, what is it? You know, why are these people coming here? Obviously, they're looking for something, but we're not able to retain them. And then I was like, you know, then I just started pulling, you know, things together. What does the bird dog community need? And basically, the gaps that I saw is where I tried to create the Bird Dog Society to fill those gaps. So.
Well, by the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, the host, and that is Jim Burris, the guest from the Bird Dog Society. If you're looking for information, birddogsociety.org is a good place to start. Jim, it sounds like, you know, for lack of a better term, you're the support group for people who have bird dog questions / issues. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we want to provide. You know, so when we pulled a lot of bird dog people, you know, as we were setting this up, and you know, kind of some of the themes that came up repeatedly was there's not mentors in our space to help us get involved with, you know, hunting or bird dog activities, whatever kind of activities, you know, shed hunting and stuff like that. One that I didn't expect is I don't know where to find birds or how to get birds to train a bird dog.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the other one was just, you know, getting plugged into a community. Like, I don't know anybody that does this. I just need, you know, people to do it with. And so those are things that, you know, through our events, and education and workshops and stuff like that, we try to do a lot of in-person workshops. You know, those are things that we try to, develop. And so on our website, we actually have a hover map on our website where you can hover over whatever state you're at. And if there's a reputable bird grower in that state, it'll pull up that information so you can know where to go, find birds. We do free webinars online so people can learn various topics on how to get into duck diving, how to take better pictures of your dog, how to do dog first aid, stuff like that. We do a lot of in-person workshops to where we work with state agencies on how to get people into waterfowl hunting or upland hunting or even shed hunting, and then partnering with states and other organizations on doing trauma training and first aid training and keeping the cost of those workshops down to an economical level. Because if we're trying to provide resources for first time bird dog owners, you know, and they don't know what they're getting into when they get these dogs, we need to keep the cost of some of these workshops down at a level that people can participate in. So for example, we have a workshop coming up in partnership with the Old Hemlock Foundation up in Brewston Mills, West Virginia. And if you're a big George Bird Evans fan, you've probably heard of the Old Hemlock Foundation, but that's basically the workshop is going to be held on George Bird Evans's homestead there in Brewston Mills. And that's a full day workshop where we're actually going to have George Bird Evans's old vet there teaching people how to deal with traumatic injuries. We're going to have another local vet teaching people how to do field first aid. We're going to have a vet tech there teaching people what do you need in a first aid kit and how do you use it. I'm going to be there teaching people how to remove dogs from traps, how to identify traps, things to look for, and stuff like that. We're also going to have Nick Adair from the GDIY podcast. He's going to be there teaching people how to avoid rattlesnakes, porcupines, and skunks. And then what do you do when you encounter rattlesnakes, porcupines, and skunks? And so we just try to empower people to be able to do that. But we're doing a full-day workshop and providing lunch for $50. And if you look at comparable workshops on those topics, you're looking at anywhere from three to $500. So.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. You look at the continuum of learning opportunities in the bird dog world. There are a lot of them, but there's a lot of gaps in there as well. And it sounds like, to a great degree, you're searching hard for the gaps and trying to fill them. Is there one particular area that just keeps coming up that people always need help with?
I think it's one of the things that comes up a lot. You know, people want to learn how to hunt, and you know, those workshops are always very popular. But something that comes up that is kind of more of a challenging aspect for us to fill is what activities to do with your dog during the off season. You know, you got training season and you got hunting season. Well, you can train a lot, but there's only so much training, you know, you can do, or sure. you're you know, before you start, you know, it's a wasted efficiency. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of activities can you do in the summer with your dogs? And so one thing that we introduced a lot of people to is the various sports you can do with your dog that don't include hunting. Shed hunting is one, dock diving, lure coursing, retriever trials, field trials, stuff like that. And, you know, our goal is just for people to know what resources are out there and for us to help you get plugged in. We may not necessarily be the ones that run those, but we'll help you find your group, you know, whether it's the Bird Dog Society or another group. We're there to be a resource to kind of mentor and give people advice on these are all the resources that are out there. These are some of the resources that we provide as the Bird Dog Society. But these are other resources out there. We have no problem sending people to other organizations because really, as our motto says, we do it for the dogs. You know, if we can make that dog happy and we can make that owner happy, you know, we've met our mission. So
I get it. And it's a fascinating way to fill a niche by filling a whole bunch of unfilled niches. And it starts to make sense the more you talk about it. Jim, one of the things that most of our listeners are going to suggest is, well, yeah, I know, but I'm a member of that and that and that and that, and I do that and I volunteer. But do you have something for the more advanced, more avid, more hardcore bird dog people who maybe know about most of the stuff? Is there anything in particular that you think a more experienced dog handler might benefit from?
Well, we have one really cool event that we did this past February, and we're looking to expand that program. We actually have some meetings coming up here soon to work on our second iteration of it. And that's called the St. Hubert's Trial.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and this is a field trial based out of Europe, and it focuses more on you and your dog as a partner. You know, how effectively do you hunt as a unit? That's something we did down in South Carolina this year. And we did it as an event. You know, most of these organizations, nonprofits, have, you know, banquets and fundraisers or some kind of marquee event, right? Mm-hmm. And we brought in people from all over the East Coast for the St. Hubert's Trial. And really, we just focused on having community, you know, getting your dogs out in the field and just having a good time with other bird dog owners. And so that's a full weekend of activities. And literally nobody wanted to leave that event just because it was so much fun. And you know, if your dog scored over a certain level, your dog was able to earn its PhD, which stands for practical hunting dog. And we just, you know, kind of made it all about the community and about the dogs. And people really love that. A lot of people that have do field trials all over the country. A lot of professional hunting guides brought their dogs there. And this was the first time they'd ever done anything like that.
Yeah.
And it just provides a completely different atmosphere, you know, because everybody's rooting for everyone to be successful.
Well, that's intriguing. I got to stop you there because number one, hey, if you don't know who St. Hubertus is, then look it up. He's our patron saint. But other than that, I'm intrigued by, tell me about the format here. This sounds like something I want to start.
Yeah. So we're going to do the second one in South Carolina again and build off the success we had this year. But we have various different classes. We have a hunter's class and we have a trialer's class.
Okay.
The hunter's class is more focused on the hunter and the dog that just goes out there and likes to hunt on the weekend. How efficiently do you work together? You know, what's the connection between the hunter and the dog? And then also, you know, the judge may ask five different questions to the hunter judge that person's ability to understand the sport that they're participating in. So, for example, one question they might ask is, all right, what choke do you have in your gun and why did you pick that choke? Or tell me the five different chokes of a shotgun. Another question might be, what bird in the lower 48 lives at the highest altitude? You know,
I'm loving this already.
and sometimes you know, at the end of the day, when the judges tally up their cards, sometimes it comes down to those questions.
Wow.
But it's literally when you're going out with a St. Hubert's trial, the judge and you are out hunting together.
Yeah.
And the conversation that you have with the judge is just like you would have with any other hunting partner. And because we don't have big purses at stake, or, you know, there's not going to be a grand champion, you know, really crowned at the end of the day, everybody's just there to have a good time and make sure their dog has a good time. Now, one thing about the St. Hubert's Trail is your shooting efficiency is part of the judging process.
Never mind then. I love it.
Proficient hunting unit without actually making game, right?
Yeah.
So part
yeah.
of what they look at is making game. But there's a pointers class and a flushers class within the hunters class. And then in the trialers class, there's also a pointers division and a flushers division. And then next year, one thing we're kind of considering is, you know, doing some type of retriever aspect of it as
sure.
well.
Sure. So. Yeah. I don't see any reason not to. I love this idea. And is there a page on the website that we can learn more about that particular event?
That particular event was this last February. It'll be next February. So our organizing committee is actually going to be meeting here in the next couple of weeks. So we'll have more on the St. Hubert's Trail coming up on the website later this year.
Excellent. Well, that right there has tripped my trigger, and there's a whole bunch more. In fact, I just got the website up here, and I'm looking at all sorts of things that somebody might be interested in. I love this approach, and I'm just going to tell you, it sounds to me like a boutique approach to cementing your bond with your bird dog, wherever you are in your careers in that world. Would that be a safe way to sum it up, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that, you know, like our shed hunt that we did, you know, most of those dogs, you know, a lot of them weren't even hunting dogs. Some of them were rescue dogs. They don't necessarily have to be a bird dog to be, you know, to be engaged in these events and be a part of the Bird Dog Society. And when we did the shed hunt last year, every single dog that came out there had never shed hunted before. Some of the owners didn't even know what a shed was. And so they all walked away there with like training kits and we provide registration packets with this. A lot of times there are people that participate in our events will leave with more, you know, in their registration bags than what they paid for as far as an entry fee, just from the support of our, you know, the companies that support us. And we're able to make the events better for the participants. But, you know, all those people were interested in it. And basically all the people that did the shed hunt last year registered for it this year. Unfortunately, we had to cancel our shed hunt this year, but just because of the amount of rain, we tried to reschedule it, and we literally got forecast for over 3 inches of rain on the 2 days that we tried to have that shed hunt. So
probably should have rescheduled it as a retriever trial.
But the shed hunt is something that we've also gotten a lot of interest from other states and organizations wanting us to do something similar there.
I love it.
Whereas teaching people new activities. But to you know, back to the your question is, you know, there was a lot of people there that were avid bird hunters and do a lot of stuff with their bird dogs. They just never tried shed hunting.
Sure.
Never thought about it. So,
well, it is a lot of fun. I remember pioneering that world about 30 years ago on my first television show, for that matter. But there is so much on the website you could learn about, and something for everybody. It's kind of a la carte, and that's another thing that I'm interested in with you guys. Jim Burris is the founder of the Bird Dog Society. Learn more about the organization at birddogsociety.org. Always something for you there. Jim, keep up the good work, and thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Scott. People can also follow us on our social media accounts as well. We're on Facebook and Instagram.
There you go. Side-by-side's getting out of control. I'll have some advice on finding places where maybe they don't go most of the time. That's coming up on the Upland Nation podcast after this word from MidwayUSA.com. Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I am a shopaholic, and they're at the top of the list for me. They've got just about everything I need for hunting, shooting in the outdoors, and maybe you too. Add them to your favorites list and then shop around. But first, sign up for email or text notifications and get 10% off your next order. Whether you're looking for stuff for camping or fishing season, or you're stocking them now, I admire this, for next fall, They've got it at MidwayUSA.com. They've got ammo. They've got fishing gear. They've got a little bit of everything that you might need in your outdoor lifestyle. Customer satisfaction is their number one goal at MidwayUSA.com. And at SageandBreaker.com, you will be very happy with their gun cleaning and care products. Everything from the bore cleaning kits with the detachable brass brush. Drop it in, pull it through, woof, you're done. Yeah, so simple. Everybody should do it every afternoon after a hunt or after a session at the range. You're sensing a theme here. Another lifetime warranty on all their gear at SageandBreaker.com. They got some cool new merch as well as some new products of various sorts. So take a look at SageandBreaker.com. Yeah, who can relate to this? Joe Rundell asked me recently on one of the social media sites. There are some states where hunting off ORVs, off-road vehicles, is getting out of hand, in my opinion anyway. And I think a lot of us would agree with that. It would be nice to find places where they don't go. And I know what you mean, Joe. You know, out in the West in particular, so much of the ground is basically open to anybody driving anything, anywhere, anytime. It gets frustrating, but if you've got less choice, smaller patches, you live in a state that doesn't have near as much federal ground, for example, it becomes a challenge. We climb all the way to the top. The birds are gone. The dog is shrugging his shoulders. Then we see the tire tracks. Well, no wonder. Well, Joe and everybody else, pull out your online mapping app and take a look at some of these types of areas to start your search for unmotorized bliss. Obviously, wilderness areas, many of which, if you look at the map carefully, are basically surrounded by roads. So you can drive right up to the edge, and some of those edges are right where the good hunting starts. Take a look at those. And then the ones I like most, especially in the West, are wilderness study areas. Now, the reason I like those is not because eventually they'll probably be designated as real wilderness where there will be no roads and will be no motorized traffic, but because most of those wilderness study areas have roads going right inside of them, you know, just penetrating them like a needle going into the cell on those, you know, Science Channel shows. They are not in the wilderness study area. If you look at the borders, the border goes along both sides of the road all the way up into the middle of that area. Those are legit. You can use them, drive up there and then hunt, but nobody can drive past the end of the road, theoretically. Now, nobody's going to stop some schmuck who's going to break the law unless you report him. So, try some of those, Joe and everybody else, and see if you can find something out there that might be motorized vehicle free. Good luck. And the road trip this week is brought to you in part by ESPAmerica.com. Yep, shot 100 rounds Sunday. And my shoulder hurts, but my ears are just fine, thank you. ESPAmerica.com. Take a look at the variety of hearing protection devices they have. The fact that they are custom fitted, and by the way, that's a simple process. You just go in to any hearing aid professional and they'll do the fitting for you. They send off the molds to ESPAmerica.com. A couple weeks later, boom, your own electronic hearing protection devices are there and protecting you for the rest of your life. Learn more at ESPAmerica.com. And once you're protected from hearing loss, head for MidValleyClays.com and start shopping for your new shotgun. In stock, two rooms full of great guns. More importantly, Dave Fiedler and the crew at MidValleyClays.com can find just about anything for you. They have a line on some of the more rare or hard to find models, certain kinds of wood, certain kinds of gauges, for example, if you're looking for a smaller gauge. They are sub-gauge central. And Dave Fiedler has offered to our listeners right here on the Upland Nation to counsel with you on the phone on any gun buying related questions, whether you're trying to decide whether you're ready for a 28 gauge, you're trying to upgrade or change from one style of gun to another style of gun, you need a pistol grip, you know, or is a straight stock right? Those are the kind of things Dave knows because he's number one, a champion sporting clay shooter, number two, an avid bird hunter. Dave can ship anywhere. Call Dave. Learn more at MidValleyClays.com. Well, thank you, Scott Trulock and Jim Burris, for your insights in our Industry Insider show this week. If you, dear listener, enjoyed the show, please tell one person. Thank you if you commented at the social platforms. We're made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, ESP America Electronic Hearing Protection Devices, Mid-Valley Clays, that's where you go for guns, Trulock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. Always something new to read, listen to, or watch at FindBirdHuntingSpots.com. I'm Scott Linden. Until I see you in the field, I'll see you there. Thanks for listening.